Talk given Saturday, 30th December, 1972. We shall deal today with the Rig Vedic god named Soma, who to me is essentially the god of inspiration. Now, Soma is one of the most elusively presented gods in the Rig Veda. At the same time, he is one of the most important, because the fundamental Vedic ritual is the Soma ritual, which consists outwardly, physically, in the grinding of the plant, the Soma plant, extracting its juice, filtering it, and then it is drunk by the celebrants. Especially there are five different types of priests who celebrate this ritual. Now, the way in which the god Soma has been presented in the Rig Veda has more or less made it very difficult for scholars to understand this underlying aspect of Soma. Namely, that he is the god of inspiration in the supreme sense of the word. Let us look at this inspiration in a way analogous to bodily inspiration. We breathe in and we call that inspiration. But when we breathe in, we breathe in that without which the body would perish. Similarly, Soma stands for that transcendent inspiration without which man could never manifest the spirit as he does and can manifest. This spirit, as we all know, is indescribable, of course. We use the word to represent that which is beyond our power, to represent, to represent. And Soma stands for that transcendent inspiration, in the absence of which we would have no chance, no possibility of touching transcendence in some way or other and letting it bring us human beings to our full flowering, which means to become completely and truly human. For to be truly human, fully human, is the summit for this species called man, and that summit means that all that we have aspired to, conceived of in our profoundest states of consciousness as divine, has really come to fruition. The human race has already produced such flowers of humanity. And those people, the perfected holy ones, are capable of entering into that state of inner silence, inner stillness, that complete absence of all selfness, in which the communion with transcendence is a realized fact, and that inspiration can take place. And when that inspiration takes place, the perfected Holy One is able to give forth a teaching in speech, which is prophetic speech, because, and it is called prophetic speech because it stimulates, it inspires the listener who listens with his heart to thrill to the reality of transcendence. Now this really is something that Soma stands for. In the ordinary way, how does the populace understand Soma? And how do scholars usually present Soma in as far as they can gather information, knowledge from the hymns of the Rig Veda? Soma is talked of as a plant. A description is given, like the description we give of any other plant or tree. Elaborate instructions regarding the preparation of this soma juice are given. And the whole thing takes on a very elaborate ritual as such. Then that juice is extracted, as I said earlier, filtered, and when the ceremonial is over, the juice is drunk by the Brahmins. Even botanical names have been suggested for this soma plant by scholars. In modern times, at least two distinguished scholars have tended to identify the soma plant with some sort of mushroom, with hallucinogenic properties. Properties which put you into a state of exaltation, which make you see visions and whatnot. For us who are seriously concerned with religion, we can put all that aside. We can put aside the speculations, even of very fine scholars, as regards the purpose of this ceremonial. Let us first understand something of the significance of religious ceremonial. It is a magic. But it takes a magician to produce magical effects, which are realities, which are healthy, that is to say, which make for the wholeness of the living being, which make for enlightenment, which make for the release of complete harmony and self-possession in the individual who has participated in the ceremonial. Now, in the old days, particularly in the old days, those celebrants of these great rituals were themselves holy men in the real sense of the word. They had realized that harmony of love and wisdom which enabled them to handle and direct psychical, mental forces without doing harm to anybody. And for their own sakes, without any desire to assert or maintain a personal authority over the people. This is very, very important. They served their people. They were the servants of humanity in the real sense. They had released those mental powers which lie dormant within all human beings and had learned the art of so directing these mental powers upon the congregation present that that congregation was changed for the better in some respect or other for good each time the person present, the participator, cooperated fully and trustfully with the celebrant. Now, the purpose of this great Rig Vedic ritual was fundamentally that purpose. The psycho-spiritual and, as a natural consequence, very often the physical, in terms of health, benefit of those who were present, the members of the congregation. And this preparation of the soma juice from a plant was merely an external symbolic process. It is not unlikely that the soma juice did have certain effects upon the body itself, but I should very much doubt whether they were hallucinogenic effects. I should rather think that they were beneficial in every respect. So much as regards the physical aspect of it. But as we have seen before at our meetings, whenever the word tree or a plant is mentioned in the old scriptures, and particularly in those of Indian origin, that is to say, Vedic origin, and those which are directly derived from the original Kabbalah, the word tree or plant means essentially the tree or plant which is in each and every single living human being. The brain and nervous system and the spinal cord. This is the tree that is always referred to. Now, it's a very extraordinary thing that if you look very carefully and critically into the hymns of the Rig Veda, not only the hymns to Soma, but the whole of the Rig Veda, you will find remarkable correspondences with the physical anatomy of the body. It's an extraordinary thing. I won't try to go into details now, simply because it is too big a subject to deal with in a meeting like ours here. Now, we might just touch upon these points because they are important. Whatever comes in the Rig Veda has not only a physical aspect to it, but of course it has its psycho-mental aspect, its purely spiritual transcendental aspect. All three aspects are present. Now, as regards the physical aspect, the division of the world is another word which is used to represent the living organism, the body, the living body. This is the world, my world. When they talk about the world, whether it be the macrocosmic world or myself, the individual, the microcosmic world, heaven stands for the brain, for the head. This is what heaven stands for. The mid-region stands for the neck, the medulla, and so forth. And earth stands for the spinal cord. And you will find this extraordinary description of heaven as consisting of two inverted bowls facing each other. But when those people say such things, obviously they are not talking of heaven as imagined by modern people. They are talking of something very, very positive, very matter of fact. These are the two halves. Your own head, which face each other. Then they talk of earth similarly, as if they were two long rods together with a central column going right through from the base right to the top of heaven. And that is literally true anatomically. Now you see, this is a very interesting field of inquiry to pursue, if one is interested in the subject at all. So heaven, the mid region, which corresponds to the psychological aspect of man, and earth, the spinal column deals with all the physical aspect of man, are all within you yourself, the whole world, the universe. And note carefully, heaven, mid-region, and earth. Now, all the great gods of the Rig Veda have their home in heaven. And from the descriptions in the Rig Veda of the properties and the functions of these gods, and their actual sort of physical shape and so on, one could work out correspondences with all that lies inside a human head. You know, for instance, how the main nerves which control our whole life start right up from the brain downwards. They are all mentioned just like that. And you will find that each of these gods is said to have his home in heaven. And then they talk of his particular function with respect to earth. and so forth. And you will find a remarkable correspondence between that description and the actual physiological fact of what happens to the body. Now, do not think, therefore, that this was their method of teaching physiology. They presented this because, right from ancient times, they had this curious, this quite remarkable insight that the microcosm is the reflection of the macrocosm. Within yourself is your whole world. Now, I would like to add something here. Let us not imagine that the totality of what we call the external universe is therefore completely represented within the whole organism that is the microcosm oneself. What is represented in the microcosm is the totality of that part of the universe which the human consciousness can touch and respond to. Otherwise, why, this microcosm would be like God Almighty, but it isn't. So, within the limits possible to man, to mankind, the ultimate limits possible to mankind, the macrocosm is embodied in the microcosm. That is why they have always taught, look within, and you will find the truth, the whole truth. Now, the god Soma deals with that aspect of this transcendent communion which enables the inspiration to take place spiritually in us. What we draw in is from transcendence in its unimaginable immensity into ourselves. And then it works out in terms of our own understanding and our own life. Let me quote just a few verses from some of the hymns to Soma. Bear in mind that of the 10 books of the Rig Veda, the whole of the 9th book is dedicated, given over to hymns to Soma, which is quite exceptional. None of the other gods have a whole book given over to them. Not one of them. Only Soma has. And the 9th book is one of the 2 books of the Rig Veda, the 8th and the 9th, which do not start with a hymn to Agni, the Lord of Fire. The celestial origin of Soma is expressed in this verse. High is thy juice's birth, though set in heaven, on earth it hath obtained strong sheltering power and great renown. Now, thou, Soma, art preeminent for wisdom, along the straightest path thou art our leader. Thou by thine insight art most wise, O Soma, strong by thine energies and all-possessing. Thine are King Varuna's eternal statutes. And as we saw time before last, at our one but the last meeting, Varuna is the embodiment of transcendent virtue. He's the moral governor of the universe. Thine are King Varuna's eternal statutes. Lofty and deep, O Soma, is thy glory. With all glories on the earth, in heaven, on mountains, in the plants, and in the waters, with all these, well pleased, accept, O royal Soma, our oblations. And so on, the hymn goes on. Now, this brings to my mind one interesting point. When a ceremonial is taking place, if the ritual is to have real magical power in it, it must of necessity be intoned very slowly, rhythmically, and in a musical voice. That is as far as the intoning goes. If it is not intoned slowly, the mind cannot concentrate upon the inner significance and meaning of the words. They become a gabble. As an example, say, our Christian, Our Father. If we were to say it, Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done in earth, it's utterly meaningless gibberish. It is irreligious to do a thing like that. But if I could completely give my total attention to the words and what they stand for, Our Father, which art in heaven, and really feel it and see it with the whole of my mind and being, the reality underlying those words is actually operative throughout my whole being. Hallowed be thy name. You see, take it very slowly and feel the power of it. Hallowed, sanctified, sacred, of the utmost worth, be thy name. What is a name? A name in the ordinary way is just a symbol. But that symbol comes to life because you have put your living soul into the whole thing. And when it comes to life like that, through your act of prayer, you release these transcendent energies in the whole atmosphere around you. This makes it ceremonial magic. So you see, something of the significance of Soma. Now here is another hymn from the Rig Veda, this time book 8, not book 9. And it's extremely interesting to us, especially in the West. The composer of the hymn starts off, "This here is Soma, never restrained, active, all-conquering, bursting forth, rishi and sage by sapience." Rishi means he who sings the songs of eternal life. That's a rishi. Now, listen to the second and the third and the fourth verses. All that is here, he covers over. All that is sick, he medicines. The blind man sees, the cripple walks. One is immediately reminded, in the Western world anyway, of the miracles of Jesus. Thou, Soma, givest wide defense against the hate of alien men. Hatreds that waste and weaken us. Now this needs a little explanation. Thou, Soma, givest wide defense against the hate of alien men. What is this hate? What is meant by the term alien men? It does not mean the neighboring state with which I am at war. We in this kingdom are at war with the people in the neighboring kingdom. Those are not the aliens. Alien men typifies, or enemies, or any such word in the old scriptures, first and foremost, typifies those who are against the trend of development of the natural process which brings man to fruition. That is the alien one. See how this applies in terms of our daily conduct. If you take the body alone, what you eat and drink, what you breathe, how much do you work, play, sleep, etc. If your life is out of tune with nature's laws that govern the human organism, then you are an alien man. You're not with nature. You're not with God. You are obstructing transcendence. You see? This is the meaning, the physical meaning of the alien man. Then you take the psychological meaning. He who hasn't an open mind and a clean heart, he is an alien man. He whose mind is filled with fixed beliefs, which is shut up, which comes to conclusions, and says, this is the final truth. As if I, a little mortal, ignorant, confused, can declare the final truth. I am an alien man if I am that sort of person. And if I am one who refuses to respond to the beneficence, the beauty, the marvel, the wonder of transcendence itself, which shows itself in innumerable ways to me every day of my life. If I am not responsive to that, if I am not awake to that, looking for it, listening for it, I am an alien man. And because I am an alien man of that sort, I am a man that is naturally full of hatred. You see, these, I don't think one comes across this sort of understanding of the hymns of the Rig Veda in the books of some of the finest scholars. They don't expound this. You have to discover it for yourself. You must meditate deeply upon it. Not manufacture meanings by using your imaginative power, by using the brilliance of your intellect to bring forth a whole series of logical steps which culminate in some what you may call a great idea or a great thought. Oh no. It's not that. You have to meditate. Keep the mind quiet, free from chattering. And then the beauty of the divine lover pours itself into through your whole being, enlightens you, makes it makes my blindness disappear. It makes my broken feet whole again, and I walk on. But if the haters are there, then those hatreds waste and weaken. So this is what the Brahmin priest prays for when he repeats the hymns in the ritual. Thou, by thine insight and thy skill, impetuous one, from heaven and earth drivest the sinner's enmity. If Soma is powerfully active within oneself, because oneself is quiet and lets Soma do the work, then this is what happens. By thine insight and thy skill, impetuous one, from heaven and earth drivest the sinner's enmity. Now, let us look at another hymn. And here, the third and the fourth verses are of special importance. Truth is the base that bears the earth. By Surya, Surya is the sun god. By Surya are the heavens sustained. By law, the Adityas stand secure, and Soma holds his place in heaven. Law here means not the laid down commandments or any such thing, but it stands for Ritta, which is the eternal order of things inherent in the whole cosmos. Inherent in the total universe is this something by which cosmos emerges out of chaos and maintains its existence as a harmonious process. This is Ritta, from which our ordinary word right, R-I-T-E, right, is derived. You see, people who really understood this in their innermost being were the people who formulated those extraordinary rituals of the past. Western Asia had it. Those few who were adepts in the Kabbalah, they knew it. Just as in India, they knew it. We have lost that in our own day and age. But don't regret it. We have lost it temporarily, because certain things have to go into abeyance in order that new factors may come upon the scene. And when the new factors have come upon the scene, and man in his pride thinks, oh, now we've got the mastery and so forth, and he gets a little bit hurt and stumbles, or I should have said it the other way, stumbles and gets a little bit hurt, then it wakes him up, begins to wake him up. But when he has properly woken up, all the old is enriched by the new which has come within his ken. So there's no need to despair or feel miserable about it. This is the way of life. Life in its immensity, in its overpowering greatness. So now, by law, the Adityas means the sons of deity. Deity means the bound. Aditi means the unbound. Oh, sorry, I said sons of deity. I should have said sons of Aditi. Aditi, the goddess, means the infinite. The absolute infinite, out of which emerge the multitude of finite manifestations. That is Aditi. And the Adityas, the great gods of the Rig Veda themselves, are the Adityas. They are the sons of Aditi. The beautiful imagination involved in all these ancient, what we call mythologies. But the myths are the vessels of truth. By Soma are the Adityas strong. By Soma mighty is the earth. Thus Soma, in the midst of all these constellations, hath his place. Now listen. One thinks, when they have brayed the plant, that he hath drunk the Soma's juice. Of whom Brahmins truly know as Soma, no one ever tasted. It is a spiritual reality. It's nothing to do with drinks. Soma, concealed by covering rules, guarded by hymns, thou standest listening to the stones. None tastes of thee who dwells on earth. Soma the god, you see, guarded by hymns, standest listening to the stones. None tastes of thee who dwells on earth. You know that physically, between these two inverted bowls, hemispheres, and covering the whole thing is the cerebrospinal fluid. And it also covers the whole of the spinal column and goes through the central canal of the spinal cord. This is the physical aspect of the Soma juice. Another physical aspect of the Soma juice is the seminal fluid. The means for the conveying of that which will ensure the continuance of human life. So now, those verses, especially that third verse, one thinks, when they have brayed the plant, that he hath drunk the Soma's juice, of whom Brahmins truly know as Soma, no one ever tasted. So now, let us try and see the significance of this in terms of our own religious living. The reality of Soma, as suggested in this verse, can never be handled, controlled, compelled by man. of whom Brahmins truly know as Soma, no one ever tasted. Not only physically, but psychologically, we can do nothing about it. Soma, that manifestation of transcendence as inspiration, which pours in spiritual life into our being, is not to be compelled or controlled. When man becomes that arrogant, he is aspiring to equality with the Almighty. All that happens to him is that he is sent downstairs to the warm place. Remember the story of Lucifer. This is the meaning of the legend of Lucifer, bright morning star. Aspired to equality with the Almighty and was cast into hell. See, in the aspiration to equality with the Almighty meant that thou, Almighty, and I are two separate ones. There are no two separate ones. There is only one. Thou, O Lord, or, if you like, whatever is the totality, the whole, the holy. It's the one and only ultimate reality. So you see, I cannot taste Soma at my will and pleasure, or through my passion to be transcendent. I can only cease to obstruct transcendence. You see, all this bears very intimately upon the living of the holy life, the spiritual life. It is to refrain from all that is evil. That is the real positive living of the holy life. Because if and when I do refrain from all that is evil, then the transcendent good is unobstructed, it is there. I have said this 5,000 times perhaps now during these 11 years with the groups. Get the dirt out of the room and the room is clean. You can't put cleanness into it. I cannot put transcendence into me or make myself perfect and holy. I can cease to do wrong and then holiness pervades this through and through. That is all. But that is all. And a tremendous all it is. Keeps us going busily all our life. Doesn't it? Now there is just one other hymn I'd like to read to you. It is in the 9th book of the Rig Veda. It's hymn 113. Soma is sometimes addressed as Pavamana. These are just a few of the verses. None of the hymns are very long. They all have a dozen or 20. Just a few hymns do run into as many as 70 odd verses. Very, very few. But the bulk of them are short things. A couple of pages or so in print, if they are moderately long. O Pavamana, place me in that deathless, undecaying world, wherein the light of heaven is set, and everlasting lustre shines. make me immortal in that realm where dwells the king, Vivasvan's son. I must explain that. Vivasvan's son is Yama, who in Rig Vedic mythology, together with his sister, is presented as the first of mortals, the first mortal. Not the very first mortal to exist at all, but the first mortal who crossed over death and realized immortality. He found his way to heaven and was given lordship over the highest of the three heavens. This is Yama. You find the corresponding myth in the Iranian, the Zarathustrian tradition of Yima. Yima likewise, you see. And of course we have our, in Genesis, you have Adam and Eve. Now, in the case of Adam, and in the case of the Iranian Yima, there is a fall which needs redemption in both cases. With Yama, there is no fall. Do remember the word, the name Adam, as presented in Genesis, typifies something very, very profound and extraordinary. We never seem to be sufficiently appreciative of the fact that Adam was on speaking terms with God. Well, he must have been somebody slightly important. See, but there is a fall. We won't go into that now. We have touched upon it occasionally in past meetings. We will go into it more deeply some other time, perhaps. But now, in the case of Yama, there is no such fall. Yama crosses over death, enters into that state. Call it superconsciousness, if you like. Call it, I prefer to use the term transconscious state. It is neither personal nor impersonal. It is neither conscious nor unconscious in our dualistic meaning of the words. If you do meditate, if you do enter into deep prayer and have some real depth of experience with these deep states, you will know what all that means. It's very difficult to put it into words in a few moments. Now, that is Vivasvan's son. And the corresponding Avastan name of Vivasvan is Vivanvant. See, the two traditions were one tradition before the two groups parted. One went into India, the other went into Iran. Make me immortal in that realm where dwells the king, Vivasvan's son. Where there is that secret shrine of heaven, where there are those waters young and fresh. The waters in such cases always means the waters of eternal life. Make me immortal in that realm where they move even as they list. In the third sphere of inmost heaven, where lucid worlds are full of light. Again, this mention of the third sphere of inmost heaven, and St. Paul's statement in 2 Corinthians, I knew a man in Christ who was caught up in the third heaven. He's referring to himself. The Christian world doesn't know St. Paul sufficiently intimately. Now, the first line of that verse, make me immortal in that realm where they move even as they list. What is this movement? It is the movement in the deep states of consciousness. It is that movement by which consciousness, which is limited to the finite, to the particular, and therefore to the mortal, frees itself from all shapes and forms, ideas, principles, thoughts, etc., etc., and moves into what you and I here would call a state of unconsciousness. But it is an unconsciousness which is extraordinarily awake. This is the paradox. This is the mystery of it. But this is the fact of it. This precisely is what happens. Mankind, through the ages, does not know of these things. It's not interested in such things, after all. Who cares for religion in the deep sense but the few? So, they move even as they list. You will find corresponding statements here and there by the Buddha also. We'll deal with that on another occasion, about this movement through what he calls the stations of consciousness, entering into them wheresoever you wish, leaving them wheresoever you wish, and so on and so on. We'll go into that in detail some other time. But this is the moving as they list. In the ordinary way, people have thought, oh, of course, these are the wish fulfillments of a primitive people. As if people who had come to know themselves were pestered any longer with wishes and the longings for wish fulfillments. This is the absurdity of scholarship. They don't know, they don't try to understand what it means to be the Holy One and how different the Holy One is from me, the ordinary mortal. Make me immortal in that realm of eager wish and strong desire. Note the words very carefully. The region of the golden sun, where food and full delight are found. And of course, especially the missionaries have seized upon statements like this similar statements which you find in Islam, that paradise is full of wonderful houris and grapes hanging and rivers flowing and all the rest of it, to suggest that they are extremely earthly-minded hedonists. Nothing to do with hedonism at all. What is this eager wish and strong desire? The region of the golden sun, the region of the golden sun typifies the enlightened state, the fully enlightened state. Aditya represents that, you see. Now, the eager wish and strong desire is very simply and straightforwardly explained in the Upanishads, where it is said outright that when a person's desire and whole longing is for Brahman, and he lives the life by which he realizes this is realized, then all his desires are completely fulfilled. But all his desires are only one desire. And they say openly that it is the desire for the real, the ultimate real. Nothing to do with earthly desires. Or our petty little whims and fancies and passions and all our human miserable folly and stupidity. Nothing to do with that. This is what eager wish and strong desire mean. And the region of the golden sun where food and full delight are found. Food, anna. Anna is the word for food. Food is, of course, spiritual sustenance. The word anna means sustenance. It also means matter. You see? And then finally, make me immortal in that realm where happiness and transports, where joys and felicities combine and longing wishes are fulfilled.